You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Friday, June 19th. Happy Juneteenth, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, not so casual Friday, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democratic Congresswoman from New York's 14th District, will be joining us to discuss the primary that is taking place in just a couple of days and more. Then we will talk to Professor of History and African American Studies at University of Houston, Gerald Horn, on the meaning of Juneteenth. Meanwhile, 700,000 young people get a reprieve as SCOTUS blocks Trump's DACA repeal. And Tulsa braces for Trump's coronavirus party as blue city mayors beg their red state governors to allow mandatory masks in the midst of a rising infection rate. A top State Department official resigns over Trump's race response. And Amy Klobuchar puts on a clinic in cynicism as she bows out of a race she already lost. Facebook nixes Trump's Nazi iconography advertisements. New York City cops are whispering of blue flu on July 4th. And Chuck Schumer's multi-million dollar Kentucky project in mediocrity seems to be failing. And it doesn't look very good in Colorado either. Philadelphia pulls $33 million of proposed police funds. That's good, but it only equals 4% of their police annual budget. All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for joining us. Glad you could. It is a casual Friday, but if you are watching, you will notice that maybe for the first time in, I don't even know when, I am not wearing a soft-collared shirt, but I am wearing my normal collared, not terribly stiff, but somewhat stiff collared, just because we're having a congresswoman on today. And so I wanted to make sure that I dressed up a little bit. And so there it is. You're wondering why I'm not as casual as normal. Very excited to have AOC on the program today. And frankly, also very excited to have Professor Horn on. He was last on this program, I believe it was almost a year ago. Maybe it was a little more. Maybe it was in 2018. I can't even remember. But it is Juneteenth, and we're all celebrating. Let's just start. I want to, in honor of having AOC on the program, let's look at this. She is running. There are, I believe, I don't think there are four or five other candidates. I'm not 100% sure, but there's like two other major ones. And she's had a couple of debates with them over the past couple of months. They've obviously been you know, socially distant on Zoom debates. Her main competitor is a former CNBC anchor, a former Republican, Michelle Cabruso Carrera, who didn't move into the district until last year. And prior to that, she was living in Trump Tower. So, that's what they call counter programming, I think. But let's see. This is the closing campaign ad from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in her race. As you know, you can vote this Tuesday, June 23rd in New York State. You can also, I believe, vote early just about everywhere in the state. You got to check your local website for your location where you can do that. Absentee ballots, I believe if you have them, send them in immediately. They need to be postmarked, I believe, by the 22nd. You can also deliver them, so mail them today. Here is the closing ad from AOC.
Right now, New York is experiencing three concurrent crises. Crisis of health with COVID-19, the economic crisis of mass unemployment, and the crisis of racism in our systems of law enforcement.
The crisis in New York reaching a critical mass.
All three of these crises has something crucial in common.
It marches across.
They haven't presented us new problems, but they've set on fire existing ones. But what if these broken systems weren't built to last in the first place? What if a better world is possible? These are systemic problems, and I'm proud to have been fighting for systemic solutions like Medicare for All, a federal jobs guarantee, and the end to mass incarceration. Today is a big day for people who have been left behind. People are coming together in an unprecedented movement to build this better future and a better world. And whether it's delivering thousands of groceries to our neighbors, introducing transformative legislation, or standing up to corrupt interests in Washington, it has been the honor of my life to fight for the Bronx and Queens in the halls of Congress. And we're just getting started. It's time to bring the movement to the voting booth. And that's why I'm asking for your vote on June 23rd.
So that's the final ad from AOC in her primary that will take place on Tuesday. We'll be talking to her in moments. But first, a couple of words from our sponsors. One is Sunset Lake CBD. I've been talking about them now for a couple of weeks. This is my, I got to be honest with you. I mean, I don't take sponsorships from products that we don't like, from industries and sectors that we don't like. And if I try the product and I don't like it, I also won't take it as an ad. But then there's like another category, which I really appreciate, which I consider sort of like a movement allies. Just Coffee is one of those. And Sunset Lake CBD, these folks were fans of the show. Wanted to advertise, and I was psyched about it, and I'm loving their products. They are a farm outside of Burlington in Vermont, originally a dairy farm that was providing, and I think it's still, they still do, producing milk for Ben and Jerry's ice cream. In 2018, they decided to diversify. It is, they are growing hemp. It's 100% pesticide free. They use organic fertilizers. They have a $15 minimum wage on the farm. Their employees own a majority of the company. And they have third-party tests. You can see it on their website in terms of the quality of what they're growing and the purity of it. They have all sorts of different CBD products. I'm deep into the tincture. It is now basically my go-to to get to bed, fall asleep at night, and it's been incredibly effective. I no longer use any of those prescription drugs that I used to fall asleep. I've had some success with the salve too. Not necessarily. It's supposed to be for achy muscles, which I feel like I'm always going to have. But it was helpful on my. I've been using it a little bit for my hands on the. This is the time of year I get my eczema, but I don't think that's what it's meant for. But and also, the CBD coffee, infused coffee, has been very big in my household. I'm now drinking that on Thursdays, and I've moved it to also. I mean Sundays, and I moved it to Thursdays. And I find that I yell at the kids a little bit less when I've had that. That's helpful. I can't do it during the rest of the week because I don't want the kids to get feel like they have too much space. But also, they also have smokable and gummy bear versions of CBD. But they have smokable. And Matt is our resident expert on things that are smokable. Isn't that right, Matt? Matt, do we lose Matt?
Well, Matt, no, I'm sorry. I was sorry, sir. I was dealing with a Facebook issue. We're now live on Facebook. But yes, I am the combustibles expert. And my method, which is to mix that in with other stuff, apparently has been seen by others to be very effective for them, too. So I'm a big fan of the CBD buds.
There you go. All right. So good. Oh, my daughter heard that comment. Yeah. All right. Well, check it out. They, you go to sunsetlakecbd.com, use the promo code Left is Best. They chose it. I loved it. 20% off. Left is Best at sunsetlakecbd.com. They have all sorts of different smokable products. They have the, gummies, and they have the, tinctures, a couple of different ones. They have the salves. Check it out. You will be glad you did. 20% off with Left is Best. Also, as you know, I'm not necessarily the, I'm a slightly sartorial challenge, sartorali. I don't know how to pronounce that. I'm challenged when it comes into dressing myself.
Sartorial.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And also, I have problems with pronunciation. But as you know, not only do I have troubles with tastes, but also it's difficult to get clothes, particularly during this time, because you know you're worried about sizes and can you buy something online? Is it really, you know, is a large going to fit me? It's tough to find something that fits perfectly. Well, Stitch Fix is a personal styling company that makes getting the clothes you love effortless. It's a totally different way to shop. To get started, you go to stitchfix.com/majority and you set up your profile. And what they do is they deliver you personalized looks in your colors, in your styles, and of course, in your budget. You pay a $20 styling fee for each fix, they call it, but it's credited towards anything that you keep. You can schedule it anytime. You don't need a subscription. Shipping, returns, exchanges, all that, all free, super easy. Stitch Fix does the hard work for you. It makes great style effortless. For me, I got a great pair of pants, Flag and Anthem. I had never heard of them before, but exactly like the style of pant that I like, and in the two color palettes that I will always wear, either blue, of course, or some type of like off green. In this case, the pants were off green, and I got those penguin chukas. Is that what they're called, Brendan? They're like they're sort of like desert boots, but a little bit nicer.
Chukkas, I believe.
Chukkas. And I returned the mock T-shirt because I don't do mock, not T-shirt, the mock shirt. I don't the mock turtleneck. I don't do that. And it was all easy, super easy. You can get started today at stitchfix.com/majority. You get 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. That's stitchfix.com/majority for 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. stitchfix.com/majority. So check that out. And as always, we will have all the links to our ads in the podcast description and in the YouTube description. All right. Do we have the congresswoman? Yes. Okay, great. So joining us now, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She's the congresswoman from the 14th District in New York. Congresswoman, welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you?
I'm hanging in there. How are you?
I'm well, day by day.
Yes, indeed. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. I just read a report from Business Insider that says a bunch of Wall Street executives, including the co-founder of Blackstone, the chief executive of Goldman Sachs, the billionaire founder of Tudor Investment Corporation, have been pouring money into your race. What did you do to them that they're so excited to invest in your opponent?
You know, it's so funny because I remember maybe last year there was a Democrat who will go unnamed. Was telling me that they were at a fundraiser last year in New York City. And there were all of these kind of Wall Street execs and private equity types. And they were fundraising for Democrats, and they had a kind of Q&A session. And she said, or they said rather, they said that like a bunch of them were just asking about me. And this member told me, you know, I realized then that they're so freaked out over just one member not being beholden or predictable to them out of 435. And they're like, she's just one vote. Why are you so stressed? And this is why, because over the last year, we exposed Big Pharma. We've exposed the military industrial complex in very material ways that have cost them millions, if not billions of dollars. So they're coming after me.
Yeah. And I mean, let's just, I was just mentioning the biggest opponent you have. I mean, there's a couple in the race, but the one who has raised the most money after you is Michelle Cabrusa Carrera. She has moved into your district after living apparently in Trump Tower. She was a former Republican. She had a plan in 2010 to privatize Social Security and Medicare. And had written a book with Larry Kudlow, of all people, back in more sprite days for Larry Kudlow. So she is now, her argument is that you are, you're not spending enough time in the district. Give me a sense of the district and where someone coming from coming from Trump Tower, has an understanding of what's going on in the Bronx and part of Queens.
Yeah, I mean, and it's really rich, her kind of coming through with this accusation, given the fact that she's never lived here. And B, you know, she just moved here 6 months ago. Maybe if she actually lived in our community, she would know that I'm home every weekend. And in fact, the only weekends that I wasn't really home in the district, which was about 4.4% of my entire time, only 4.4%, was when I was with Bernie on the campaign trail trying to get him elected. And so, which was just kind of, you know, 4 or 5 weekends. And so, you know, it's wild, but the thing that I think is really interesting is the narrative that she's running with, that I like don't get along with the party enough, which is really, we have a Republican funded opponent who's running as a Democrat saying that I need to fall in line, which I think is just such a perfect encapsulation of US politics right now, which is that, you know, there's more affinity and more of a relationship in terms of capital, in terms of big money, between kind of the more conservative elements and of the Democratic Party and actual Republicans than we actually have affinity structurally with progressives who put working families ahead of corporate interests.
Yeah, and actually, I want to get to that. Before we do, though, I want to talk just a little bit about, I guess this dovetails a little bit what your closing ad was, which was recounting the three crises that we are going through now, and in particular your district, which is in many respects, you know, sort of like the epicenter. Within the epicenter, on some level, of all three of these crises that you listed, but your response is that we need a systemic response, addressing of these issues, as opposed to short term fixes. Give me a sense of how you walk that line between both what you need to provide locally, but also dealing systemically means that you've got to do that almost in Washington.
Well, you know, it kind of mirrors. It's all part of the same thing. So, for example, if we start with COVID and the economic crisis with COVID along with the health crisis, on the ground, we started with mutual aid networks. So my campaign, we fundraised about almost $1 million, about $850,000 direct to district, directly to mutual aid organizations, which is kind of a It is a radical form of social organizing with roots in the Black Panthers and even earlier with food assistance programs. And so instead of, you know, trying to bankroll palm cards and whatever, during COVID, we started going directly into mutual aid networks, which is a completely unique form of organizing that is really built for moments like these, that is built on principles of community care and this idea that we do not need to be controlled by corporations in order to sustain ourselves. And then that kind of trickles up towards our models of legislation that we push. Those are the same principles that Medicare for All is based on. Those are the same principles that a lot of social, a lot of our legislation is rooted upon as well. The fact that we don't need to be reliant on corporate power in order to lead prosperous, healthy, and happy lives. So whether it's COVID, whether it's how we're structuring and dealing with mass unemployment, which, by the way, when you have corporate power consolidated to such an extent, yeah, you can lay thousands of people off at once because it's one corporation deciding that. But then thirdly, we have the issue of racism in law enforcement. And I represent Rikers Island, which is home to some of the worst atrocities on U.S. soil when it comes to mass incarceration. And really, it's not about the four walls of Rikers. It's about the entire system of punitive and the carceral state that creates a Rikers. Because you can close this Rikers, but if you keep the system open, a Rikers will pop up somewhere else in the country.
Right. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about the response to at least two of those crises, I guess, in Washington. That's the we've seen it in the context of the CARES Act, seeing it in the context of the HEROES Act. You voted against CARES Act. You voted for the HEROES Act. First, let's talk about the CARES Act. Why'd you vote against that?
Well, the CARES Act had, sure, it had some funding for hospitals, a couple billion for hospitals. It had no state and local, no relief for undocumented and tax-paying immigrants, and no relief for mixed-status families. So those three in particular made the thing untenable, because if you're trying to contain a disease and you are not providing the economic means for the people who pack and deliver our food, the people who touch and deliver everything that comes to our homes, you don't give them the economic ability to stay home if they're feeling sick, then it's not a pandemic assistance bill. But the really important part of this as well is that while it had a couple bucks for hospitals and other forms of relief, it was not a relief bill with a corporate bailout tucked into it. It was a corporate bailout bill with relief tucked into it. It had $500 billion in unfettered money for Wall Street that was then being leveraged into $4 trillion, which is being completely unaccountable to, which has virtually no standards, and the oversight for it is a joke. This was a massive corporate giveaway and a huge restructuring of power in the United States. And we're really, you know, while people are going to make a fuss about voting against it because it had a buck against a hospital and say, oh, you know, you voted for $5 against a hospital, we are really going to see in the years to come exactly right how we were betrayed by that aspect of this legislation.
Well, I think we've yet to even get the congressional committee that's supposed to be overseeing where that money went. As far as I know, they haven't even met at this point.
And it's going out the door already.
And that, I mean, that gets to you know, sort of the next point I wanted to make, which was that we heard a lot about structural change in the context of the campaign, at least the presidential campaign, that has subsided a little bit based upon who is now the presumptive nominee. But it really does feel like the Republicans use this opportunity to create structural change that we're going to see down the road as, you know, everyone's driving under the yellow flag, except for the corporations who get the green flag. But I want to talk about the Heroes Act, which was a message bill. Mm-hmm. You voted for this. Well, what was the message of the Heroes Act? I know it was much bigger, but there was a lot of like, it seems to me that for a bill that everybody knew was not going to go anywhere in the Senate, that message seems very, very mixed.
Yeah. Well, you know, I do think that towards the end, while we were winding down on this bill, we started to hear from leadership this actually wasn't a messaging bill, that they actually are trying to negotiate this with McConnell, which we'll see. You know, from what we're seeing, McConnell is basically sitting on the Heroes Act in the Senate and waiting for everyone's expanded unemployment to expire to use as leverage so that everyone is desperate and then he can, you know, push through something else that's terrible. But if it is intended as a messaging bill, I don't think it's a strong one, but I do think it tends to be the strategy of House Democrats, which is we're going to send a really strong message by packing in a bunch of things into a massive kind of omnibus style piece of legislation when really, even in this moment, right, with police brutality, just repeal qualified immunity. I think that's a really strong message. Like, we just passed one bill that did one really powerful thing, and then maybe you pass another bill, and maybe you pass another bill. But the problem is really building those coalitions. So I think that's why these quote-unquote messaging bills tend to be so watered down, because you don't actually have a majority of Democrats that are willing to do the strong message. So you have to cobble together kind of a huge package of legislation that doesn't necessarily meet the ends that we need right now.
But when I look at like some of the things that we're missing, like no automatic stabilizers, right? I mean, that just seems like poor governance. I get the fact that the number would be big, but what's the difference between $3 trillion and $4 trillion, right? Like I nobody can conceive of either number. But COBRA, let's talk about this. Because I mean, if this is a message bill, the message is we're going to provide for the American public the most expensive possible version of health insurance we can provide. Mm-hmm. We're not going to have automatic stabilizers because that's going to look like it's too expensive.
Right.
But we're going to subsidize the most expensive and efficient way that we can provide health insurance. I mean, you voted for the bills. I mean, how do you justify that in that context?
Well, I do think that subsidizing COBRA is trash and it's horrible. For me, one of the tipping points for this legislation, and, you know, for what it's worth, like, it is, I'm just going to say it's a sausage factory in multiple ways. And so you have to decide which terrible things that you're going to have to, in any given piece of legislation, you're going to have to tolerate for other things. And so for me personally, the thing that was a tipping point in the Heroes Act was Democrats did do something unprecedented, and it was really hard to get them to do this, which was include ITIN payers, including immigrants and undocumented immigrants, and including mixed status families. Democrats are notorious for being very weak on immigration policy. We're terrible at it. And this is the first time that we've really seen relief on this level extended to farm workers, extended to, you know, Uber drivers, the people who are delivering our food, domestic workers, and so on. Anyone who pays an ITIN, which is millions of undocumented people, will get a stimulus check. And in the desperation of this moment, I think that that was really important. But I don't think that that absolves the legislation. And we really should be applying pressure on Democrats who think COBRA is better than just expanding Medicare to the unemployed. COBRA is horrible. It's terrible. It's a corporate giveaway. And even in addition to COBRA, we also had two options, which was Pramila Jayapal's Paycheck Guarantee Act, or it was this like payroll tax deduction. And they went with like a payroll tax deduction that people, that just a small class of employers would feel a year from now, which does not help our situation right now. Whereas Pramila's bill guarantees paychecks and also helps people transition from unemployment into employment without getting too hard of, you know, without getting a financial hit with the expanded UI. And so, you know, it's I think it's embarrassing, but at the end of the day, there is a corporate consolidation of power. There's a very strong corporate wing in the Democratic Party that we have to continue to organize against. And we are starting to expand that power.
Yeah. I mean, let's talk about how that works. I mean, right now we're watching a race in a district next to yours in the 16th. Jamal Bowman is doing very well against Elliot Engel. I mean, we can only tell so much at this point. We're going to know more, obviously, at the end of day Tuesday. But the it seems to me that that is sort of been a that's a little illustrative of what you're talking about here, right? Chuck Schumer just jumped in to endorse in that race. Like, why is Chuck Schumer that excited? Why is there this level of, you know, you mentioned, you know, why is Wall Street going after you? Your one vote. You're in, you know, like, do they really expect to have a Wall Street crony representing the Bronx? Why is there this much? I mean, are we seeing like a fight against progressives for the sake of saying we're going to beat progressives, as opposed to like, we need Elliot Engel in there because we need that vote against the next bill, you know, the next deal against Iran?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that there is kind of a disproportionate ire aimed at progressives. But I mean, maybe that's just me talking personally because I am one. But I also think that, you know, 2 years ago when I won against Joe Crowley, it was kind of an emperor has no clothes type of moment. And I think that people got extremely concerned because he's not the only one that is in that type of position. Because the thing when it comes to corporate power, especially in the Democratic Party, is that there's more of us than there are of them. And by that, I mean there are more progressive voters and people in the Democratic Party. Our policies are more popular than there are numerically of people who support corporate policies. And I said it back then, and I say it now, you know, we've got people and they've got money. And in order for this kind of corporate hegemony to sustain itself, it requires Democrats in deep blue seats to support things like payday lenders, Wall Street brokers, private equity takeovers, etc. And that's been the big secret all along, right? Where you can combine, if you can combine these deep blue seats with representatives that support Wall Street, that is the tipping factor. Or, you know, it's not just Wall Street. It's our prison industrial complex. It's our military industrial complex. It, you know, all of these fingers of the same hand. And so the key is these deep blue seats supporting these atrocious policies that are supported by payday lenders and all of these folks. And once that starts, once you kind of get a crack in that, it gets very, very scary for a lot of these deep blue Democrats that are supported by those same interests. And so, you know, I think that there's that, and also seniority in the House is a whole different ballgame. And so people want to protect those kind of the structural and procedural power where that derives. And so all of that kind of combines for the protection of policies and kind of this center of the universe that is these very well-funded kind of least representative interests.
So, I mean, is that part of the strategy? I mean, as you look, I mean, obviously, like, you know, I think you're in a position that I think very few, frankly, freshman Congress people have ever been in, for that matter. You have an ability to fundraise that challenges people who have been there for decades. You have name recognition that is, you know, in many ways unparalleled. So when you're thinking about how to build these coalitions, is going for those blue state Democrats in those deep blue seats who are, in your words, if I understand what you're saying, basically providing cover for the rest of the caucus to move to the right because they're ostensibly in the deepest blue seats. Is that part of the theory? Go after those and turn those first?
Well, I think that those seats tend to be very accessible for the progressive movement, right? It's accessible to the progressive movement. It's a lower lift in resources because it's already in our pocket, right? Whereas, yes, you can. I believe that you can swing a seat with a progressive candidate, absolutely. But it also costs $15 million to do so for one vote. Whereas you can run, and we can better use our small dollar resources. Take that $10 million, scatter it around other seats, and then even if you don't end up, if that candidate doesn't end up pulling through at the end, you still get a dramatic shift in the incumbent's behavior as well. And that should not go ignored either. When I was running against Joe Crowley, he all of a sudden, I announced that I was going to run for Congress from behind a bar. And I was behind a bar working brunch at coffee shop when I found out that he signed on to Medicare for All like a week or two later. And so then he started co-sponsoring all of these progressive policies just by the fact that I was running, even when I hadn't fundraised anything yet. And so I think it's more, you kind of get more bang for your buck in that sense, but it also takes very good progressive candidates, and I think that that's something that we need to be disciplined about as well. It's not just about supporting any person who just rolls through and slaps a bunch of progressive policies on their websites. It's about, does this candidate have a history in the community? Do they have a context, a cultural, racial, socioeconomic context for the community? Have they served in any way? Doesn't mean that, have you worked yourself up the ladder of electoral politics, but Jamal Bowman is a school principal for 20 years. Like, he knows these families, he knows these kids, and he can effectively champion these policies in a way that, it is more than social media is an incredibly important role, but it's also goes much deeper into kind of this candidate service. And, is there a real deal here? Is there a history here?
Right. All right. So lastly, last question for you. Once you've, where the dust settles and we get a house, after the 2018 election, let's assume for the sake of argument that the Democrats take the presidency, they take even the Senate. What do you do? You got 40% of the Democratic caucus is progressive. How do you work that inside game and make, there at least there's a plurality there, right? What's the strategy to assert more progressive power within the caucus where there clearly seems to be some breaks on that?
Yeah, we even have to be careful when we say 40% of the caucus is progressive as well, because there are moves that are made where the progressive caucus actually has no entry standards. Like, in order to join the Progressive Caucus, you don't have to sign on to Medicare. You don't have to be a co-sponsor of Medicare for All. You don't have to be a co-sponsor of the Green New Deal. There's no kind of, you don't have to not be financed by corporate PACs. Like, there's no real pledge. You just kind of pay the caucus dues and you're in. And so as a consequence, there are a lot of these deep blue Democrats who say they're part of the Progressive Caucus, but actually aren't pushing progressive policies behind closed doors. In fact, they work against them. And so for us, I think it's still a continued, it needs to be like real continued pressure on progressive movements and those folks that say that they are progressive, because 40% is a lot. And even if we're able to expand that majority in the House, which I believe is also possible, now we're talking about making real movement. And so I think it requires a lot of outside pressure, but inside, we're going to have to also work a lot on supporting the standard bearers and uplifting them in positions of power. Barbara Lee ran for chair of the Democratic Caucus, and she was essentially kind of undercut by a more conservative wing of the party. And so we need to have our inside game in terms of uplifting and making sure that we're surging some of those progressive standard bearers in the same way that we also have an outside game. Because when you have, Pramila Jayapal or Barbara Lee or any one of these progressive leaders, Ilhan, Ayanna Pressley, et cetera, pushing on whether it's decarceral policy, whether it's healthcare policy, whether it's, you know, foreign policy and beyond, we have to make sure that we've got their back and that we are keeping attention to the inside fights as they are happening. Because so often the reason we lose them is because folks realize that votes happen after they happen. Whereas corporate elements of the party are very well attuned to to what the business that's on the floor. And really that 48 hours before a vote is the most important 48 hours in determining the outcome.
They've got the resources to sort of do a little more advanced planning, as it were.
That's right.
Congresswoman, thank you so much for coming on. Good luck on Tuesday. Really appreciate it. We're big fans here. My daughter is a huge fan, and I have now become much cooler in her eyes.
So I appreciate tell me to say hello.
I will. All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Really appreciate
Bye.
It. Bye-bye. All right, folks. We're going to take a – are we going to take a quick break or no? We got a minute, Brendan?
We have a minute here, yeah.
Okay. Well, so there it is. Ladies and gentlemen, you can find out more. I think if you Google Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, you can find her website. I don't have the website here to get more information, but I don't know if there's any internal I don't know. I'm not aware of any polling that's been going on. She has raised significantly more money than even the former CNBC host who wants to privatize Social Security. But I mean, I have to wonder if they are that like tone deaf that they would run someone like that against her, or if, you know, I don't know. They think that's the ticket. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Professor Gerald Horn, the Moores Professorship of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. We'll be right back after this. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Professor Gerald Horn. He is the professor of history and African American studies at University of Houston. And the author, his latest is coming out in July, The Dawning of the Apocalypse, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, Settler Colonialism, and Capitalism in the Long 16th Century. Professor, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for inviting me.
I'm looking forward to your new book. I remember when you were on last time, and like I say, I can't remember if it was in 2019 or 2018, but you had said that you were you basically had covered in some ways that book is the prequel to your the last book that we had you on for, which was, if I'm not mistaken. Gosh, I lost it, but it was like the apocalypse. We were full in the apocalypse, the roots of slavery, white supremacy, and that was in the 17th century. Thank you for joining us. Let's talk about Juneteenth. I think people know maybe a little bit of what Juneteenth is about, that it was that it marks June 19th in 1865, when essentially the Emancipation Proclamation was read in, I think it was Galveston, Texas. Tell us more about just the basic facts of this holiday.
Yes. And first of all, the 16th century book is now out. So you give me your address, I'll send you a copy. But in any case, with regard to Juneteenth, June 19th, 1865, Major General Gordon Granger of the Union Army shows up in Galveston, Texas, off the coast of Southeast Texas, not far distant from Houston, Texas, from where I'm now speaking. And according to the traditional story, tells the enslaved that they're free. Recall that the Civil War had ended in April 1865, a couple of months earlier. But even though I support the move, and of course, there's just been a bill introduced in Congress to make Juneteenth a federal holiday, and corporations like Twitter have stolen a march on Congress by granting their employees Juneteenth as a day off, and I support that wholeheartedly. But the story is actually a bit more complicated than that traditional narrative. First of all, the Emancipation Proclamation, coming into effect in January 1863, did not necessarily apply to areas where the United States did not exercise effective sovereignty. And that certainly included Texas, a bulwark of the so-called Confederate States of America that seceded from the United States in 1861 in order to perpetuate slavery forevermore. And then secondly, there was this lingering feeling among slaveholders in Texas that if the Confederacy collapsed, Texas, which after all had been an independent country between 1836 and 1845, and only joined the Union in 1845 because it was under so much pressure from British abolitionists and other global abolitionist forces. And so if the Confederacy collapsed, Texas had this idea that it would rejoin Mexico, from which it had seceded in 1836 because Mexico had moved to abolish slavery in the 1820s under a president of African and indigenous origin, speaking of Vicente Guerrero. You may celebrate Cinco de Mayo here in the United States, which is a major holiday for people of Mexican origin, which marks a clash between Mexican forces and the French puppet forces under Maximilian. Maximilian, of course, had given a warm embrace to the Confederate States of America. And so the idea was for Texas to rejoin Mexico under Maximilian. But fortunately, what happened is that the Mexican people, in league with black soldiers, I should add, including George Washington Williams, who was an early black historian, collaborate to squash Maximilian, leading to his execution, putting paid to this diabolical idea of extending the lease on life of slavery that these Texas enslavers held dear. However, I should say that unpaid labor for Africans did not necessarily end magically
right
in June 1865. It continued for some time. How long is unclear. And certainly a kind of neo-slavery arises to take its place, speaking of the convict lease system, whereby black men in particular were arrested on a flimsy pretext and then leased en masse to the same plantation owners who supposedly had freed them on June 19th, 1865.
So if I hear you, your I guess ambivalence is a function of people misunderstanding exactly what happened at that moment, and that Texas was really this isn't about Texas pride, and it really isn't in many respects about a status change of sorts for black and African slaves at that time.
Well, I'm not ambivalent at all. As noted about Juneteenth, I salute those who are pushing that as a national holiday. I particularly salute West Coast Longshore, which as we speak are shutting down ports from Seattle to San Diego in solidarity with Juneteenth, in solidarity with the idea this should be a national holiday, and in solidarity with Black Lives Matter. I'm only questioning the traditional interpretation, which I think makes rather simple and smoothed over a very complex and complicated history, and in some ways lets the enslavers off the hook, because independent Texas was a major slave trading force. Galveston was a major slave trading port.
Right.
That is to say that the Lone Star flag could be found off the coast of Africa with the kidnapped then brought to Galveston, oftentimes transshipped to Cuba. One of the reasons you have so many black people in Cuba is because of the manic energy of these Texas slave traders. They would also ship Africans to Brazil. That is to say, the slave vessels would sail straight from Texas, from Galveston, to, say, Angola, load up the ship with kidnapped Africans and take them across the South Atlantic to Brazil. And so a lot of that history gets sort of smoothed over when you just talk about, oh, you know, General Granger shows up and tells the Negroes they're free, and then they begin to celebrate.
Right. Well, now, so let me ask you this, in terms of like the development of the marking of Juneteenth, as opposed to the, let's say, I don't know, the day that the Emancipation Proclamation is signed. Like, I mean, how, you know, why, and I hear you that, like, you know, the end of the process, as it were, and I don't know that we're, you know, really fully completed this process, but the end of the process, at least in the context of the official Emancipation Proclamation, regardless of what what's happening on the ground per se, you know, would have been in 1865 as opposed to 1863. But what does it mean to celebrate that day as opposed to the day of the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation?
Well, first of all, the train has left the station with regard to Juneteenth. I think it's too late to claw back that particular date, particularly since Congress is moving forward. Black organizations wholeheartedly endorse Juneteenth. It's marked, I believe, in 47 different states and in the District of Columbia. We expect Hawaii to join the 47 sooner rather than later. And so I think that the importance is having a day on which there is a solemn remembrance of the horrific nature of slavery, and then using that process to connect the horrors of the past with the carnage of the present, recently seen on the streets of Minneapolis, the streets of Atlanta, Staten Island, and too many other bloody sites, too numerous to mention. That's important. With regard to Emancipation Proclamation, you may know that many historians, particularly black historians, have been revising their opinion, shall we say, of Emancipation Proclamation. This idea that it did not apply to areas over which the Lincoln government had jurisdiction, such as Maryland and other states that controlled slaves but did not bolt into the Confederate States of America. So it did not apply to them, but it applied to states where they did not exercise meaningful sovereignty, such as Texas. That seems a bit slippery, too clever by half. And so I understand why people are reluctant to hang their hat on the Emancipation Proclamation.
And my understanding is that the first Juneteenth was actually celebrated the next year, in 1966. Is that right? I mean, excuse me, 1866.
Well, sure. And as we speak in southeastern Texas, there are going to be many remembrances. I mean, it's a grassroots project. I mean, and I think this is how things should work. It's a project that came from the grassroots, that came from below, that is to say, from black people themselves. And then it's adopted by others. It's adopted by Twitter. It's adopted by other corporations. It's adopted by states in the right. District of Columbia, now introduced into Congress. And to me, that's a model of how we get a day off that's paid.
Right, right. But I mean, is it, I mean, I guess, and part of the reason why I wanted to have a historian such as yourself on is, you know, in some way, as that, this is the most prominent, I think, Juneteenth has been, at least in my lifetime. And I think a lot of that is a function of what's going on in the streets right now. The speed in which it's being subsumed by what you're talking about, the corporations and, you know, 25% off on all furniture, this, you know, Juneteenth. I mean, I don't know how far away we are from that. Seems to be, maybe it's just the nature of our society today, but, having it be interpreted properly and celebrated properly seems to be hugely important. And it's almost like, and it's also, it's shocking that we don't, that this is, that it hasn't really occurred to the society at large to celebrate this, particularly, I mean, I've come to understand through, frankly, from your work and others, you know, in looking into Reconstruction, you know, much of what happened, much of the America that we live in today is formed in those, in really those years from 65 to, I guess, you know, 75. I mean, the Reconstruction has at least set up a template for our civil society today. It's sort of shocking that we don't have anything to sort of commemorate and to make people consistently aware of it.
Well, if the 45th president were on the line, I'm sure he would intervene and say, as he said in the Wall Street Journal today, that actually the popularity of Juneteenth has a lot to do with himself. Mm. He says that when he decided to have this rally, this is going to take place in Tulsa tomorrow on June 20th. He originally was June 19th. He said he brought a lot of attention to this idea and helped to thrust it into the spotlight. And so you may want to give him a shout out or give him a pat on the back as a result of, say, the rooster helping to bring the sun into the sky in the morning, for example, by crowing. But in any case, you raise a very serious question as to the fact that slavery oftentimes goes unremarked in the United States of America. I remember in 2007, when Britain was marking the end of Britain's role in the African slave trade, 1807, the 200th anniversary in 2007. Then Prime Minister Tony Blair spoke, the Queen spoke. It was a big deal. It went totally unremarked in the United States of America, even though, of course, the United States of America was a major slave trading nation. It was even the recipient of many of the enslaved brought on English and British vessels. And I think there's a certain level of discomfort with slavery in this country because it tends to disrupt the immaculate conception theory of the creation of the United States, that creation myth that sees the creation of 1776 as being flawless and perfect. Of course, Nicole Hannah-Jones of the New York Times won a Pulitzer Prize just recently for an essay in August 2019, marking what she said was the 400th anniversary of the arrival of slave Africans, where she suggested that slavery had something to do with 1776. And of course, all hell broke loose. The establishment historians have begun to attack her in scurrilous terms and actually haven't stopped to this very day, which I think is unfortunate because, as many leading historians have said, our obligation to history is to frequently rewrite it and frequently reinterpret it because different generations oftentimes have different historical needs. And I think that that's what's happening today as we speak. A younger generation is looking for an interpretation of the past that helps them understand the present. And I think a lot of the past interpretations, they help to bolster a kind of liberal narrative, which put liberals in the forefront of the struggle and I guess made them feel good about living in the United States. And it tended to downplay indigenous dispossession and tended to basically indicate that there were more people involved in the abolitionist movement than there actually were. And so now people are looking for an explanation for Trumpism. I mean, how did we reach the brink of catastrophe? How did we reach this precipice? And this sort of overdetermining of liberalism as being the motive driving force of the creation of the United States doesn't fit with Trumpism, who as of today, we cannot say this force will be defeated on the first Tuesday in November. So I think that reality is crying out for new interpretations. And I think also that the black community is crying out because the black community is trying to explain this carnage in the streets, trying to explain this pornography of violence captured on tape that's leading to lynchings in public with officers of the state nonchalantly executing this grisly task while staring into the camera as if they were taking a walk in the Sunday park.
Right. I mean, that's fascinating. I mean, just to, because I really do feel, I mean, that I am personally, in terms of like my understanding of history has changed dramatically over the past, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, I would say, based around the question of race in this country. I think I've said, in the past, I think it's, Carol Anderson's White Rage, I think sort of just was one of the pieces that came together for me to see that there's a real continuum here. I mean, and I think that's what you're suggesting is that, you know, we need to reevaluate history to get a sense of exactly how we, our estimation as a society of what paths we took have been, do not jibe with where we have ended up. On some level, and it suggests that maybe we didn't follow the map that we thought we followed. Do you think, with that said, do you think that there is a danger in looking at slavery as a binary? I mean, slavery is in and of itself is binary on some level, but the forces behind slavery, the societal context in which slavery is created is not binary. In other words, that you get the Emancipation Proclamation, then you get, this, it read in Texas. But if I remember correctly, the general who read it basically said, like, incidentally, not much is going to change. Like, you got to go work and you can't really get paid that much. And that those forces, just because we said slavery ends, those forces that constructed slavery continued on to construct other functions that in some way function in the same way that slavery did. Does that make sense?
Well, certainly convict lease system, which I've already made reference to, was a kind of neo-slavery. And I think there's always a danger when one seeks to reinterpret history because the interpretation may not stand up. I mean, to give you an example, historians, whether they acknowledge it or not, they start off with a theory of the case. I mean, for example, I'm doing a book on Texas as we speak, which is why a lot of this material is fresh in my mind. And so part of my theory of the case was with regard to collaboration between the enslaved African population and the indigenous, particularly the Comanche. So when I'm going through documents, I'm taking notes on that. But then what kept popping up on my in the documents was the enslaved population collaborating with their masters to a degree against the indigenous population. Now, the way historians usually work, they stick with their theory of the case and they don't take notes on something that does not comport with their theory of the case. But I felt compelled, and I do feel compelled, to try to explain that what I consider to be a kind of anomaly. And it was an anomaly because the collaboration with the indigenous was much more prevalent. But the lack of collaboration, it seems to me, deserves an explanation. And I think that that's been part of the failing of the historical establishment. So they have this theory of the case and they stick to it. And then I think that leads to misinterpretations. I mean, for example, Oregon in the 1850s, when it enters the Union, says no Negroes allowed, no slavery allowed. Now, the historians oftentimes say, oh, Oregon is anti-slavery. Well, yeah, but they also don't want any Negroes, period.
Right.
Free or slave. And it's the same with Georgia in 1733, when it becomes a settlement, a British settlement. It says no Negroes allowed, no slavery allowed. Now, the historians stick to the latter. Georgia comes into being as anti-slavery. So how do we explain this anomaly of it becoming a major slave state? Well, you know, just refer to the fact that they said no Negroes allowed. So certainly there's a danger with interpreting and reinterpreting history. But I think those dangers can be avoided with certain kinds of clear methods.
Okay, so I got to tell you, I'm super excited to check out the Dawning of the Apocalypse, your latest book, and we're going to have you on for that. But give me a sense of how do we celebrate, aside from, like, you know, with the hopes that, you know, next year, maybe in the years to come, folks will have the day off on Juneteenth. How do we celebrate? I mean, what is there, are there, has there been any sort of concerted attempt? Was there in 1866, was there a, were there means in which to specifically, you know, I don't know, traditions or whatnot? I mean, I, you know, in my own sort of, sense of things, you know, Passover as a holiday is to celebrate the emancipation of the Jews from Egypt, essentially. And we have very ritualistic things, but how, within the context of Juneteenth, are there other things that, and if you were in charge, are there some that you would want us to adopt?
Well, it's just like the King holiday, which I think has been revisioned as a day for volunteer service, for service to humanity, by working in soup kitchens, by registering people to vote, and the like. With regard to Juneteenth, I think that historically it's been a day of solemn remembrance. It's been a day of reflection on how this catastrophe was unwound, speaking of slavery. And I would like to see an extension of that tradition. Once again, I think that if we are to ever understand these eruptions from the Atlantic to the Pacific, and in fact globally, over the past 3 weeks, you really have to understand slavery. And once you begin to understand slavery, as Michelle Bachelet, the leader of the United Nations Human Rights Council, announced the other day when that they had these hearings on, quote, systemic racism, unquote, in the United States of America, with the brother of George Floyd addressing the body in Geneva, Switzerland. Michelle Bachelet not only called, and she's a former leader of Chile, as you know, the president, she not only called for a repairing of the torn fabric of Black American society and ultimately U.S. society by dedicated means of reparations, and she did not limit it to the United States. She also spoke about colonized Caribbean, colonized Africa, et cetera. And so I would like to see Juneteenth being a day for rededication to what Michelle Bachelet has already articulated. That is to say, helping us to understand this carnage in the streets and helping us to try to forestall a further eruption of carnage in the streets.
Gerald Horn, thank you so much for your time. We will put a link to your newest book at majority.fm and look forward to having you on to discuss it.
Fantastic. And have your aide send me your mailing at your postal address and I'll send you a copy.
I will do. Thank you so much. Appreciate it, Professor.
Thank you.
All right, folks. Brendan?
I don't know who he was talking about.
Sean.
Or Patrick, yeah.
All right, folks. Just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Listen, if you're listening in Kentucky, get ready to vote. Charles Booker, really, if you want to send a message to Chuck Schumer, or to any of the establishment of the Democratic Party, you can do so. You have a lot of opportunity in the next couple of weeks if you're in Colorado, if you're in New York, if you're in Kentucky.
Delaware.
Chuck Schumer has spent, spent, I mean, he hasn't spent it personally, but a ton of resources on promoting Hickenlooper and Amy McGrath. And Hickenlooper has fallen apart. McGrath has fallen apart in these two states. I don't know if Romanoff can win in Colorado. I don't know if Booker can win in Kentucky. I don't know if Bowman can win in New York's 16th district. But make sure you go out and vote. You still have time to support those candidates. Very good chance, not a very good chance, there's a chance, a legitimate chance, the Democrats are going to take back the Senate. And the difference between Romanoff and Hickenlooper. I don't know if McGrath or Booker can win in Kentucky. My guess would be probably not, but who knows? Will be a big, big difference. Even one or two votes in the Senate that are not siding with, you know, what Chuck Schumer wants to do is he wants to have members in his caucus, as I believe Nancy Pelosi does. They want to have members in their caucus who are to the right of them on one hand, so that they don't have to move things in too much of a progressive direction. And as AOC explained to us, they like having these deep state blue representatives who are corporatists because they work the other side of the spectrum. And so they narrow the Hickenloopers, the Kristen Sinemas, the Manchins, the Heidi Heitkamps when she was in. They narrow it on the right side. And then on the left side, they get these blue state Democrats who can project themselves to be progressives, and they narrow the options that are available. And one of the quotes that AOC had that I didn't, I forgot to bring up was, when she was at, the Queensboro Bridge for the, Bernie Sanders rally. She said something to the effect of like, I can't find it here, but it's something to the effect of like, you know, Sanders, made her aware in 2016 of just like she expanded raising the expectations for what politics should mean, raising the expectations of what politics could deliver for people in terms of, you know, raising the expectations of what is a right. People have a right to health care. They have a right to housing. They have a right to an ability to have a living wage. So this is a real opportunity. It's not dramatic. And it would have been more dramatic had we had a presidential candidate who reflected this. But, you know, maybe it just means that we're not quite there yet. There's not quite enough power amassed. And the way you amass this power is sometimes in spikes and sometimes it's in more incremental ways. But you have an opportunity to influence it over the next couple of weeks and do that. I don't know how we got there. I was giving a promo to become a member of the Majority Report. But also make sure you vote. Check out the AM Quickie. We got merch now too at shop.majorityreportradio.com. shop.majorityreportradio.com. We're coming up with, and if you have like ideas for what we should put into the merch shop, by all means, let us know.
We're working on some new stuff.
We're working on some new stuff, says my aide, Patrick.
Please stop.
And don't forget, tune into TMBS this week, the Michael Brooks Show. Some guy named Noam Chomsky was on.
How about them apples?
Was on the program. You can find that on YouTube and obviously patreon.com/The Michael Brooks Show. Also, Nomi's show, Namiki Show on Patreon, patreon.com/The Namiki Show and youtube.com/The Namiki Show. She's talking police reform and talking about candidates. Check that out this week. Jamie, what's happening on the Antifada?
I'm so glad you asked. So this week on the Antifada, we have not one, but two interviews that we have stitched into a single show, NPR style. The first is with our friend Alex Edward from the podcast Minion Death Cult. He is a Seattle resident, and he speaks with us about life in the Chaz or the Chop or Antifa Stan or whatever you want to call it. right now. It tends to shift in name, but the autonomous zone in Capitol Hill. Talked a little bit about life in the auto zone and what that's like. We also speak with a listener named Matt Marciniak, who is part of Justice Frontline Aid, a mutual aid project in Minneapolis that's helping liberated goods find their way to the people who need them. And then Sean and I do a little bit of commentary. I think we did a good job. Check it out. Patreon.com/TheAntifada.
Matt, what's happening on Literary Hangover?
I'll be hitting the high seas of the North Atlantic tonight in Assassin's Creed Rogue while listening to a few more chapters of The Pilot by James Fenimore Cooper.
How many different games are you playing simultaneously?
That's a big question. I mean, like dozens, I would say. I got a big hard drive here.
Now, can I ask you this question? Do they still have like, you're going through levels, or is that sort of old school that you actually?
No, there are some levels. They'll call it like chat. Oh yeah, you can finish these games. Some you can't finish, like the sports ones. But I finished A Plague's Tale: Innocence while listening to Daniel Defoe's Plague Journal, for instance.
Because back in the day when I would game, I couldn't switch. I had to finish a game before I could move on to the next game.
Oh yeah, I got like 8 that I'm currently progressing through.
Yeah, I think that's just I'm like that with food too. I got to finish my peas and then my potatoes and then my, you know, Brussels sprouts or something like that. I can't mix it all together.
I cook it all at a different time. So I'll cook one dish at one time, then I'll cook another dish and just kind of snack over the course of a few hours. I don't do all my cooking at the same time.
Well, that's weird. All right, folks. See you in the fun half. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance. My first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But
Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
Hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.